News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on KMJ, whether you're listening to us on 580 AM at 1 o'clock, maybe on the FM side, 105.9, the frequency at 5 o'clock every Saturday, or online at kmjnow.com. Hopefully you've figured out what this show is all about, that we want to honor our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices that they've made. We want their stories to be preserved so the rest of us can learn a thing or two and be inspired by stories from our greatest generation. Today we're going to hear part of the story of Bill Bohegan, 86 years old, a Fresno native and a Fresno fixture. Maybe he sold you life insurance. Maybe you voted for him for student body president at Fresno Tech almost 70 years ago. Maybe he's told you some of his Army stories. We're going to hear about what he did in World War II, take you right to the front lines and enemy in his foxhole. That's going to be a very interesting story we'll hear. But let's start out earlier than that. Part of the Armenian-American culture here in Fresno that is such a rich part of our history. And there's a church downtown. A lot of people have driven by. If they have gone to Selland Arena or anything in that neck of the woods, they've seen that beautiful red brick building. Been there over 100 years, and I understand your family had something to do with that?
Oh, yes. Yes, my grandfather happened to be the first priest there, and he also helped build the house, that brick building over there. And everybody tried to help at those times. That was way back in 1913. And I'm still not sure if he was a priest fully or a deacon. But it was way before my time. I was born some 13 years after the church was up. I was baptized way back there. And it's a beautiful church. It's always been a good, beautiful church. And we had some problems between the countries about Turkish and Armenians and some of the terrible things that happened in those days. And because of it, there was a split. And so part of me went over to St. Paul Armenian Church. And Holy Trinity is still going on their own, which is fine, and I wish them the best. And we're trying to hold up on St. Paul also.
We're going to be talking about World War II, but I'm interested to know, as a young boy growing up in Fresno in an Armenian family, how often did you hear stories about what had happened and why your family and others had come to America?
Every one of them had a different feeling, I suppose, as they came, but they knew they had to get out of Turkey. It was dangerous for Armenians, and they did. In fact, my grandmother took her other daughters, and they wanted to take my mother also because she was only 8 years old at the time. But there was a grandmother there that was about 65 years old, and they were going to leave her in Armenia. My mother, who was 10 or 8 years old, said no. She says, I'm going to bring her. I'll bring her to America, which I thought was quite a brave thing for an 8-year-old to do it. Somehow, some way, she brought her over. She had a little problem with an irritated eye. The eyes had gotten something wrong with it, and they were going to turn her back for Ellen Island. They weren't going to let her go through. But she talked and talked and got to talk to the captain of the ship, and she expressed that her grandmother was very healthy and everything, and if she got anything, it got it right in the ship. And it just happened. I don't even know it should be said that the captain of the ship was an Armenian, which was quite lucky. And so she talked to him, and he finally says, okay, we're going to let her go through, make sure that she gets well and everything else. So she came over. So we're very, very thankful.
As this time in the world started to unfold and you caught news of what was happening in Europe and what the Nazis were trying to do, and even the way Japan was treating its neighbors, maybe even Russia, do you think you had a different perspective on it because of the stories you had heard from your family about the persecution of the Armenians?
No, I don't think we would be putting that with what Hitler was doing and what Japan and Italy was doing. I think that every nationality would look at their problems, but this was not a part of World War II. World War II was something else when they attacked Pearl Harbor. I remember I was only about 15 and a half years old, and when I heard about it and what it was all about, we didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. We weren't that well educated about Hawaii. But when we found out, and then when FDR gave us the speech about what had happened and how they overran us and killed over 3,000 of our soldiers and sailors on a surprise deal, was very bad. And I said, son of a gun, I'm only 15. I would want to go in this and defend our country immediately. But the war went on for another 3 years or so. And all I can say is I'm a lucky man to get out of there. I got put in the draft. I delivered my own papers and put them at home as a postman.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you about that. I don't know, and I've heard a lot of stories from hundreds of veterans, but I don't think I've ever met someone who delivered his own draft notice to his own mailbox. So you had graduated from Fresno Tech High School in 1944, and you got a job with the Postal Service?
Well, as soon as I graduated, I went to the post office and got the job. And there was a guy named Schmale. He was one of the nicest guys. He gave us the training and all. And I covered over 13 different routes. Some of them were on bicycles with a basket in the front on the west side of Fresno, and also around T Street and Tulare, all around up in there. The questionnaire came out when I was 18 years old, and the letter came, and I was covering my home route, and I put the envelope in my mailbox, and I was kind of happy. And about a month later, I got another one, and it was greetings, you might say, and that was approving and telling me that we were going to go back into the service. And that letter also came, and I delivered it, put it in my mailbox. And so what else do you want me to tell you about that?
Well, maybe get a little taste of your life before you joined the Army. I know that you liked playing basketball and baseball growing up. And there, I believe, before you headed overseas, there was a certain young lady that caught your eye, right?
Yeah. I was told not to run around and do things, but it just happened that I ran across my girlfriend, whose name was Barbara Issaquilian. And that Issaquilian was really something. When she'd send letters to me after I went to the Army, and they'd look at the envelope and say, what is this, Ishkabob? There was a movie in those days, a name. And I said, no, don't get smart around there. But anyway, she waited for me, and I spent about a year and a half overseas, and finally got out. And when I came home, and she's been the only girl that I've ever been with, and I'm very thankful for that. And we've stayed and raised three boys, and we've got about six or seven grandkids now. And I just found out that there's another little young lady coming out, another about 6 months from now. And so we're very, very happy, and all the kids have been good. And this country has been good to me. And I want each and every one of you to take a second look at your country and be thankful that you can get up and speak and be reasonable about it. Remember, there's an awful lot of people with a lot of interest in this country, and they look at things a certain way. Understand it. It can't be everything that you want, and they're not going to get everything they want. But be thankful that we have a country like this with all the leaders, from George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and all of them, and Theodore Roosevelt and FDR and Eisenhower. Eisenhower did a tremendous job getting us out of Korea. I'll never forget that. And all I know is that whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, just be a good American and don't go around hating people. Tell yourself, I don't agree with the person. That's nice. You don't have to agree, and they don't have to agree with you either. Okay?
That's good advice. So you mentioned meeting Barbara, going overseas, corresponding with her, and then coming back to marry her. You've been married ever since, 65 years now. You ever realize that those three boys you talk about, all those grandkids, none of them would have ever been born if things had worked out a little differently in combat for you?
Well, they're definitely. It was just...
Because you had some really close calls in combat overseas. Tell me maybe first about getting into the Army and how you took to being an Army man. I know you're a big, strong guy, 6 feet, 2 inches tall, and you still have the strongest handshake of anybody that I ever shake hands with. But was it tough to adjust to life in the Army? Did they toughen you up even more than you already were?
I had seen so many John Wayne movies. And all of the heroes, you know, in the movies, James Stewart and all these other guys, they've done beautiful films. And I want to be a guy telling you that those films they made back in the 40s, those songs that were written from World War I, and the fellows who wrote those songs, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, those people should be always respected, doing the beautiful things that kept the flag flying. And as for me, I love the flag more than most people know because I appreciate so much that's happened with my parents who came from countries that were in a backward way. They count a lot on religion. And the only thing I say about religion, whether it be any of them, the religions, just remember that God up there wishes to do good things. And if they're doing bad things in a religion, they're not doing what the God wants. The God wants good and get along with your neighbor. That's something that has to be learned. Don't turn around and say, oh, this guy's this way or that way. Don't do that. Every one of us, we're not perfect. Try to be a person that doesn't hurt somebody else. Defend yourself, but don't go around hurting people.
Well, I know you would be put in some situations in the service, in the war, where it was either you or somebody else. And we're going to talk about that when we come back. It's commercial break time. We'll be back with 86-year-old Bill Bohegan of Fresno, California. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
That bed, I heard my wife say, in a way that I knew she was either really, really happy or really upset. Paul Leffler here for Sleep Retreat, and if it had been the latter, I wouldn't be telling you about it. No, she was excited. That bed, she said, is so comfortable. She had just gotten her first taste of our new Tempur-Pedic mattress from Sleep Retreat, Fresno's only premium bedding store. And I'm not making this up, she didn't want to move. That's how much she loves the comfort and support that Tempur-Pedic's technology delivers. This is not one mattress fits all. The trained professionals at Sleep Retreat can walk you through the whole spectrum from soft to firm. But the one thing all the Tempur-Pedics have in common is they adapt to your exact shape to support every part of your body. If you've slept on a conventional mattress your whole life, like I have, this is something you've never experienced before. Do yourself and your sleeping habits a favor by trying out the most recommended bed in America. Visit your Tempur-Pedic Comfort Center in Central California. That's Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall.
delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with an Army veteran of World War II. Bill Bohegian is 86 years old now, but as a teenager, he ended up in the U.S. Army in the 32nd Infantry Division. And I'm curious, as you prepared to head overseas, you have no idea when the war is going to end. Now you know how close to the end it was. But what do you remember about your expectations, your mindset, what you were focused on as you headed overseas?
Well, of course, we got on the ship and had over 4,000 troops. Yeah, well, we took off at San Francisco. We went under the Golden Bridge there. It was quite a deal because I looked up underneath the bridge and looked at all the rivets, the big round rivets up there, and I was 18 years old and looking up there, and I said, I wonder if I'm ever going to get back. But we had 4,000 troops, and we went out, and we went out about 6 days. On the 12th, we heard that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had died, and most of us were feeling pretty bad about that because the president had been there for at least 12 years, and a lot of us were only 18, so we were only 6 years old when he was the president. And some of the guys were talking very nice about it, and one guy was talking pretty rough about it. And he got a little ugly and started talking bad about the president. And I told him, I says, you better watch your language, because if you don't, I says, I'm going to throw you overboard. And, there's certain things that I just won't put up. I don't care if the guy's a Republican or Democrat or whatever. He's the president of the United States. You show a little more respect than that. But we went on from there. We went to New Guinea and stopped at Hollandia and a few things there. I won a little prize there. I picked up a number of 58, and we docked, and it was 858. 8.58 of the time. That won me, I believe it was either $10 or $20. It was a prize. 5 minutes later, a guy come up to me and says, you got that money there. He says, and I'm in bad shape. I'm really hurting. And he was a guy that would come in and parachute down. He started talking to me, and I kind of felt sorry for him. And I'm saying to myself, well, I don't need the $20 for criminy sakes. He says, no, I'll give it to you when we get back over to in Manila. So I gave it to him, but I never saw him again. I got conned on that. But where I was going, we really didn't care about money because there was no place to buy anything. Well, all we had was a little tin cans, a little fire we could carry, and a fork and a knife. And you didn't have a place to wash it either. You just shoved it in the ground and washed it and wiped it, and that was it. And you'd eat the next meal. But we went from New Guinea to Leyte, and then we docked at May 6th in Manila. And we got off the ship on the 7th, went in, and they're all looking around, and they took us over, put up some camps where we're going to stay. The combat was going on all over, and you never know if they were behind us or in front of us or wherever, but we were going to be shipped up. And then about a week later, they called us up and said that tomorrow morning we're going to go take Santa Fe Hill. And it was no hill. It was a real mountain out there, about 4,000 feet. In fact, they were told it was 6,000, but looking at it, I didn't think it was over 4,000. Remember, I'm only 18 years old, but I had my Garand rifle, had my shells, everything. They woke us up at 11 o'clock at night and told us that we were going to go in on May 25. And we were subject to mortar fire and machine gun and just about everything that could happen to us. And we were going to go up this side of this mountain, and it's a clean area where very little trees and bushes. And we figured, well, this will probably be the day. It'll be over with. And I could just see my name in the Fresno Bee a week or so later that I perished. But luckily, when we went up and with the amount of troops coming up, I think the Japanese saw us coming and they took off. And we were very, very fortunate. We went up, and for the first week or so, we had terrible times. We had no water. And I remember we were going around doing the things, but there was no water up there, and it wasn't raining. I remember laying on the ground there. Just, I didn't care if a nip had come up and wanted to shoot me, and I'd say, do it. But finally, they had some halts. These guys were about four and a half feet tall, and they came up with the little 5-gallon tubs, or whatever you'd call it, and they'd bring it up and gave us some water to put into our canteens. We had 2 canteens, and they'd fill in one, and they wouldn't fill the other one. They said, we don't know if you're going to get any more water. So we were having some pretty rough times up there. And
so you talk about the people bringing you the water. These were Filipinos, because you're on the island of Luzon, and the battle is raging. So these were Filipinos whose land you're fighting for, and they came to your rescue in a way with this water.
They really saved us a lot. Normal Filipino was at least 5'5", you know, people. And these kids, these guys were just muscle bounds. They were beautifully bodied people. And that water, I'll tell you how bad it was. I remember thinking when I was on 3302 Butler Avenue and playing around with the hoses and throwing the water on my brother be throwing water on me. And I says, dear Lord, I says, if we can just get some water right now, boy, I'll never waste water again. So you never know what you're going to do when you go into a combat deal, because your life is out there. And if anybody sees you and he thinks he's got a chance, he'll take a shot and get you. But if he thinks that maybe it'd be a little dangerous for him, because we had automatic weapons, and they had Nambu machine guns and things like that, but they were trying to get out of our way because I don't think they were getting supplies that they normally would have gotten. We were getting stronger and stronger, and things were getting rougher on the Japanese. There was no doubt about it. The grudge and everything that goes on, I hope we've forgotten that, because I've had a DVD that I made, and I wanted to show what kind of people Americans were. Once we won the war, we wanted to treat the Japanese as there was no war. That was my belief. Now, I'm sure a lot of guys will never forgive, but I would hope that they would. But in Christianity, forgiving people is what Christ is all about. And all I know is for 65 to 68 years now, the Japanese have not caused any trouble for us at all. And the Japanese people are very polite.
Well, and I know you got a taste of that firsthand as part of the occupation forces after the war was over. But at this point, in May and June of 1944, on this hot island in the Philippines, with at times no water to drink, an enemy lurking, and again, you're just a teenager at 18 years old, I'm sure it was a very uncertain future for you. And you had some pretty intense experiences. You're an infantryman. You're on the front lines. I've always been mystified by how anyone could even try to sleep in situations like that, especially knowing the Japanese tendencies to raid in the middle of the night and kill people. And this was a real danger to you. How close did a situation like that come to impacting you?
You know, we'd go out every morning and check what we had done, and we'd find the Japanese laying back on the trails up there that we had to go up. We'd travel out 50 yards, 100 yards, 150 yards. Look, we find some dead and so on and so forth. And then at nighttime, we get back into our foxholes right on it looked like a Y where the trails came through to one trail, and we were posted right on the end of it. And the Japanese would come in at nighttime and sneak in and try to kill everybody on our platoon. And it just happened that one of the other fellows had the same thing I had, where they snuck up right up to him and to me, and he killed just in time where a sword went right past him, just missed his head and everything, and he was pretty well shook. Then a few days later, we had one that came right up to me also, and I was standing there, and the other two guys on the side of me were sleeping, and so on and so forth. Every other hole had a person standing or sleeping. This fella came up, and I was nodding and falling kind of asleep, and opened my eye. And as I opened my eye, this guy came right up. Now, the little Japanese helmet came right in front of me. I could reach over and tap him on the head. And his head came up. I looked at him. I came down fast and put the safety off my rifle, and I was ready to fire. And he started to go right back down right in front of me. I waited for him, and then he come right back up slowly. When he got up as high as he could, I took my rifle and start firing at him, and made sure that he wasn't going to do anything after that. So that was the end of that part. And then I also took a grenade. I wanted to throw a grenade out, and this all happened within 3 seconds. And I pulled a pin and let the lever pop in my hand, and I counted 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, and I threw it, and it ripped all up. And I was questioned about that, whether I really did that, because I counted 1,001, 1,002, 1,003. The grenades take about four and a half to 5 seconds, and they'll go off. And if you just take them and throw them out there, you pop it out there, they're sizzling. The Japanese could take it and throw it back into our foxholes, and that's the reason I counted three and let them have the four and five.
And you did that, and this is in the middle of the night. This is 2 a.m. You don't know how many more Japanese are out there. You don't know when another one's coming your way. And you also have to stay in your foxhole with a dead Japanese soldier a foot or two away from you until the sun comes up. What was that like?
It actually had nothing. I didn't worry about it. I knew I had got the guy. In fact, one of the fellows told me, says, in fact, it was my platoon sergeant. He says, what happened? What happened? And I says, I got him. And he said, and he shook his hand and he threw him. He says, oh, you didn't get anybody. I says, well, you wait and you'll see. I says, I'm telling you, and you're telling me that I don't know what I'm doing. And so this guy, who was my platoon sergeant, when the war ended about two or 3 months later, he turned me over to become the platoon sergeant. Can you believe that? But that's what he did. And that fellow right now is about 88 years old, and he's in Ukiah, California, a wonderful guy, and a good name, George Kennedy. And every time we say that, they say, is that the guy that was in the movies, the big blonde-haired guy? I said, no, this is a little bit different. And he, when he took off, he put me back into the position as the platoon sergeant.
When the sun came up and you saw what you hadn't been able to see in the middle of the night, what did you find, and what did you have to do to deal with it?
George Kennedy went out and saw that the fella had passed on, and went through the wallet and everything else. And he says, Bill, he says, you want the wallet? You want this? You want that? And I said, I don't want anything on it. But he opened up the wallet, and he showed me the picture of the Japanese fella, in a picture with his wife and his two children. And he brought it over to me, and I looked at it, and I said, wow. And he was sitting there in the chair with a sword, and very proud of his family, I suppose, and everything else. And I said, I don't want the picture, so I gave it back to George Kennedy. And what I was thinking to myself was that, you know, I have put this father away. They'll never have another father like that. And I says, I feel sorry for the mother and the children. I thought it was just that war is a terrible thing. You have to defend yourself. There's no doubt about it. And my belief in war is that do everything but not start a war, but be strong enough to defend yourself. If I had my way, I'd get the best boxers, the best fighters of the country, and let them argue a little bit and see who wins. And when they get through, say, okay, we'll go my way or your way, and not spend billions of dollars with armament and everything else.
Well, I think I kind of like your boxing idea, too, and I know that you're a former boxer yourself, and that's where that idea came from. But getting back to your days in the 32nd Infantry Division and this Japanese soldier who sneaks up on you in the middle of the night, you see the picture of his wife and his children, and you feel sorry for him. I imagine your children are thankful that you did what you did, because they would have never been born had you not done what you'd done. And I'm wondering, too, is it possible that you saved not only your own life, but maybe the lives of some of your fellow soldiers by taking that enemy out?
You know, there was about maybe 25 or 30 of us up there, and I think we all think about the same way. We are trained to defend ourselves there, and at the same time, we're on offense. We're out there to get the Japanese out of the Philippines and get them back to Japan, and that's the way we were going. And all I can say is I've never carried any of the hate. I don't like people attacking other people. And that's probably why I talk to us, our own people. If I was talking to the generals of our country, I would say, make darn sure that what you're doing isn't making it worse for us.
Point taken, and you certainly have the perspective of someone who has been on those front lines, seen the horrible cost of war. Bill Bohegian, 86 years old, of Fresno, California, our guest today. We'll get more of his World War II Army experiences when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 86-year-old Bill Bohegian of Fresno. By the way, if you're on Facebook and you haven't clicked like on the Hometown Heroes page yet, make sure you do that. That way you'll see all the photos of each week's guests when they're posted there. There are also some good ones this week on KMJNow.com. You'll see Bill's smiling face on there when you pull that up, the Hometown Heroes section. I want to thank Rod Stubblefield for encouraging me to talk to Bill. They've been colleagues for years at New York Life. Maybe you've bought insurance from Bill. Maybe you played basketball or baseball against him in high school. I hear he once hit for the cycle for Fresno Tech against the Roosevelt Rough Riders way back when. Maybe you faced him in his competitive softball days after World War II, or maybe you are meeting him for the first time today through this program. We've heard about how he delivered his own draft notice and how real the war became for him as an 18-year-old infantryman in the Philippines, serving with the 32nd Infantry Division, the 126th Infantry Regiment. We talked about that incident in the middle of the night where the Japanese soldier was right on top of you and you had to fire those shots to take him out. That's just one day. but it was day after day on the front lines, knowing the enemy was near, not knowing what was going to happen. How exhausting was that? And what do you think helped you stay focused and survive?
Well, to be honest with you, be very clear what happened, because we were there to fight and everything else, and all of a sudden the notice came through. And a notice came through that if you're 18 years old, you had to be pulled off the front lines. And I said, I'll be darned. And Harry Truman, the president, said, no, the war is going well. He says, but we don't want no 18-year-old right on the front line. Pull him back. So I was in that group. So they took me, and what do you think they put me back to? On the fifth road, the highway that was pretty busy, and sometimes we had enemy running through there at night, and they'd get through there. They put me on the bridge to guard it. And you know who was with me? Nobody. Guarding a bridge at nighttime, scary as ever. That was another place that I was there working out there. Then the next day or so, they had me protecting the water. They had a Lister bag that was about 7 or 8 feet wide, 5 foot tall. It was all full of pure water. They got me to guard that water. And so here I had this circle around this thing in this dark, dark place, nobody with you. And all night you'd be walking around, make sure nobody poisons the water. And then finally they called me up and they said, you're going back up to the front. And so I survived it, and that was pretty good. In fact, there was one other thing that was real funny. Well, on the bridge, all of a sudden, about 2 or 3 Jeeps coming down with some big licenses on them, and everything is showing there's officers coming. And the guy up front, he's kind of pushing his arms back and is trying to identify that what's behind him is a general. All of a sudden, it starts raining, and I've got my Ponto. I'm putting that thing on. I got my helmet on sideways, my rifle between my legs, and this thing is coming up here, and I'm looking at it, and the thing is raining like crazy on top of me, and the guy's going this and that, you know. I caught on to it, so as he came by, I got my rifle down here. I put my arm up here, and I get my helmet, and I turn around, and I salute him. And I look at, and the general looks, and he sees what I'm doing, and he broke out laughing. And they just drove right on through. It was really something, but it was really kind of scary that, you know, how sloppy can a guy get? But anyway, then they take me up to the front lines, and now we're going to go, all of a sudden, 2.5 miles into enemy line to find out just where these guys are, and we're going to probably confront them. And so what happens, they call up this one guy, Dixon, and he says, you're going to be the lead scout. He says, Bohegan, you're going to be in the rear. And Dixon says, no. He says, let him go be the front way. He says, I've been here 6 months later. He says, and he don't want to be the first guy, because the first guy could probably get killed much faster. And so he says, okay, Bohegan, he says, you're going to be the lead scout. They took my rifle away from me, and they put a BAR in me, because one of the fellows couldn't carry it. It was too heavy for him. It's a 20-pound weapon. And we had to carry our about 10 magazines. He says, Bohegan, you're lead scout. I says, with a BAR? He says, yeah. So everybody's following me. Here we got about 25, 30 guys going down there. We got to be careful what we're doing. And in my training, I was taught that don't go too slow, because if you go too slow, they'll pick you out. And if they think they can hit the target and not miss it, they'll do it. So I told these guys, I says, you follow me, but we're going to move and we're going to keep going. We kept going, and we had to go up the hills and down the mountains and everything else. And I'm going along pretty fast. And now it's raining also. We're slopping around. We came to a big opening where there's about maybe 25 yards open between the forest to the other side. And it's a good place for them to pick us off as we go through. So I told them right now, I says, I'm going first, and I'm going to go through pretty quick. And I says, nobody comes after me until I'm on the other side and everything's okay. Because, boy, if they start blasting, we're done. you have a Nambu machine gun or something, they'll kill about five or six of us real fast. I says, there isn't going to be anybody but one guy at every 10 yards at least and moving. So if they're going to hit one or two of us, that's all. And we went through there, and fortunately I went through, they went through and all that, and we kept going, and we didn't run across anybody. They just wouldn't do it. We'd once in a while go off the track, and we killed a few of them one time, and another thing happens, but usually it was all night fighting and them coming out at night. But when I got over there on a telephone, they crank it around, we got the news. The A-bomb had gone off. That was on August the 6th of 45. And 3 days before that was my birthday. I had turned 19. And I remember that very clearly. And the orders were, do not fire at the Japanese unless you're fired on. They bombed Hiroshima. And then Harry Truman had told them that in 3 days, I think it was, that they had to come up and surrender. And if they didn't, we were going to hit them again. And they didn't. And so they had gone over Kokura. And that was rained in, or it was, I think, fogged in. And they went on to the other one, Nagasaki.
So you mentioned actually being on patrol when you get the word that the atomic bomb has been dropped on Hiroshima. Looking back now and having read everything you've read and learned everything you've learned, do you think that that bomb being used the way it was could have saved your life?
No doubt about it at all. As a matter of fact, I go a little bit further than that. For many, many years after that, I could pray for Harry Truman, who had the guts to come out and give those orders to use that bomb or those bombs. I knew Harry Truman by his honesty. He was not the greatest thing in the world in certain ways, but he had good, he was a captain in the World War. The buck stopped there. He was very honest in what he did. But always remember, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, or anything, they do what they do as what they believe is the right thing to do. They're never going to be 100% backing you. It's a tough thing to be a president of the United States and make decisions like that. But the only thing that I'm really happy about is that the H-bomb probably had to be shown somewhere. And if it was going to be shown at all to an enemy that attacked us without any warning at all, I think they deserved it. But those people that died, it's too bad. They were probably very innocent people, just like you and I. All I can say is I hope the United States will always look at itself as a Christian nation and try to stay out of war, but never let anybody push her around.
And I think your perspective on the atomic bomb specifically is a little deeper than a lot of ours, because one of the duties that you had after the war ended was going back into Hiroshima about 2 months after the bomb had been detonated. What did you see there, and what was the significance to your understanding?
We came down to Hiroshima on a train, and it pulled right up at Hiroshima, and they said, here's Hiroshima, and there wasn't much out there. There were buildings, and the only buildings that were standing up there were concrete, and everything was burned out that we could tell from the rail tracks. You just couldn't believe it. The galvanized and everything had been thrown all over the roofs of homes and everything, and the homes are all wiped out. It's just absolutely terrible.
And in post-war Japan, the occupation forces, General MacArthur set up his headquarters in Tokyo. And I understand that before you came home, you had a chance that you could have stayed there and worked for General MacArthur, helped guard him.
They wanted a guy like me, 6'2". I was a staff sergeant, and they wanted me to enlist for another 4 years. I told them that I'd be honored to do that for MacArthur and all that, but they wanted big fellas, and I guess they wanted an impression that don't fool around over me in my office, and that was it. But I had a girlfriend that was waiting for me to get married, and we were both in love. And I came to the war because of the war. But I didn't come there to go into the job of being a warrior. I would defend my country anytime. As far as I'm concerned, if you're going to have a war, send guys that are 80 years old into it and let the young guys live, will you?
Well, if we sent 86-year-olds like you, we'd have a pretty good army. I know that. What was that reunion like when you got back and you saw Barbara again after, I'm sure, many nights where you weren't sure you were ever going to make it home?
They put me on a ship, the PA-233, I believe it was. We came from Japan back to Washington, Seattle. I remember Joe Louis was fighting an Italian guy. It was really something. And the black guys were basically, they were cookers and bakers and all that stuff in the bottom, and they'd bet with the Italians about who was going to win that fight. It was really something. And we came in, and that fight was going on, and they had it on the loudspeaker, and they were talking about it and the fight, and it was going to start, and it started and everything else, and everybody was excited. They said, oh, it went in, and this guy, all of a sudden he hit Lewis, and all of a sudden the sound went off. And we said, wow, what happened, you know? And the weather was real rough outside, couldn't pick it up, and all of a sudden the thing came back on again, and it's going 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And we go, oh, God. I says, Joe Louis lost his fight. He says, the other guy got knocked out. The Italian guy got knocked out. He says he hit Louis, and Louis got mad and went after him and nailed him. And it was so funny because the Italians figured they had it and that the blacks won it. So the beautiful part is you got to love them both. One had to lose, one had to win.
So after you heard that fight and didn't hear the fight and heard the end of the fight, you got into Seattle, you made it back to California, and you got to see Barbara again. How long did you wait before you got married?
We waited about 6 months. That was my mother's fault. She says, when are you going to marry this girl now that you're back? And I said, Mom, I've only been here a little bit. Let me look around a little bit. And she says, oh, no, you won't. I'll never fit. And she said something in Armenian that I don't want to repeat. But I always loved my mother, and I always somehow listened to her because she always wanted me to be a good person. And if you are not doing too good and you find out you're not too good, apologize for what you're doing that isn't right. And those are the things that my mother lives, and she will never die in my mind. And I wish that people would follow advice like that.
Well, I'm glad you did, and I'm pretty sure your mother would be very proud of you, Bill. Thank you for serving our country, and thanks for sharing a few of those stories with us. For you at home, I did get to listen to a few more stories from Bill that didn't quite fit into our time slot today, but I've added them to the Hometown Heroes podcast. You can find that at kmjnow.com. And if you run into him, be ready for that grip. Maybe you'll even get Bill to share more memories from his days as an Army infantryman in World War II. Thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes today on KMJ.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
I don't like people attacking other people, and that's probably why I talk to us, our own people. If I was talking to the generals of our country, I would say, make darn sure that what you're doing isn't making it worse for us. Because when you kill people of any nationality, Some of them may love the United States from what they've learned from us. But on the other hand, if you go over there and start knocking off people because some of them are bad, and you kill the bad and you kill some good, now the good people say, oh, my, gee whiz, the United States killed my son, and we thought the United States was wonderful. And that hurts me. That hurts me. And I think you have to speak up. And I'm not trying to criticize anybody. I'm just saying, let's change our methods a little bit. Stay strong militarily, just like Paul tells me I've got a good grip. That grip has helped me stay out of fights. Because when guys are arguing with me, they think twice before they try to attack me. And I say thank you, because I don't want to hit anybody. I don't want to hurt anybody. And when I see somebody trying to pick them, I can tell you a story that happened when we came out of combat. I saved a guy. You want me to tell them about it?
Of course.
Well, we went there. There was a guy there, a guy named Heine. He was a German guy, and he was a nice fella. I didn't know him that well. We had a company street there with all the tents in there, and he's fighting with a guy, Jew. The guy's a Jew. Can you imagine this? And this Heine, he's got his shirt off, he's got furry chest, muscular, everything. And he's getting this Jew, and he's bending his arm. He's doing things to him. And I'm sitting there, and I was writing a letter, and I'm looking up there, and this Jewish guy is going, hey, 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 you're hurting me, you know. So I yelled out, and I says, hey, Heine, why don't you pick on somebody your own size? And so he stopped, and he looked over at me, and he says, oh, he says, okay, boy, Egan, what's the matter? He said, you know, you don't like it? He says, no, I don't like it at all. He said, why don't you come up here? I says, well, if you'd like, I will. And I went up there. And when I walked over to him, he's looking at me, and he's starting to get ready to wrestle with me. And I says, okay, where are you ready to, where should I flip you? And I crossed my hands because I knew how to do some jiu-jitsu. And when I crossed my hands, I said, all right, where do you want to land, Heine? And he turned around and he says, oh, don't pull that stuff on me. Don't do that stuff on me. I said, well, you just better not pick on him anymore. And he walked away. He just walked away. And you know what I thought? I said, isn't that wonderful? This guy is a tough guy. So you never know if I would have got hurt or not. But I feel like I have to defend people who are getting pushed around. I don't like pushing around. Talk straight and try to work it out so we don't have to fight. But if you have to fight, fight clean. And I'll never forget when they were doing testing around in Nevada on the atomic bomb. You know, when you talk about being bright, I get excited about these things. I was hoping that I could be there to see that bomb go off. The only trouble is I had to stay there until I came and they had tested, and they didn't talk about it, but some of the guys that were some mile away or 5 miles away, they got some injuries from it. Very, very bad weapon. And then when you're talking about big ones, the Russians have 100 megaton, will clean out in one bomb, they claim as big as San Jose to San Francisco. And I don't know why anybody would want anything to do with that at all. So we should be negative on it. Don't use it. That's all I can say. But we ought to remember how bad it is and how many innocent people get killed, regardless of race or anything like that. All races have good and they've got some bad. And just a little bit, if you're making soup, the soup is good, but that little fly get in there gets to take the notice. And if you work on that too much about it, then the whole soup gets bad. Just get it out of there, clean it out, and keep going. throw those guys out, fix them out, train them, do something, bag them on the side of the head, maybe they'll wake up and hear and start becoming good people. Okay? If somebody beats you at something, you don't like it, but go over to the guy and say, you're a better man than I am, at least today. Maybe next time I'll beat you on it, but be friendly about it. Don't be a bad loser. And have competition. There's nothing wrong with competition. And always know the guy who's competing with you is a human being. Treat him right, and he'll treat you right. Okay?
And you're talking about advice. What advice do you have for those of us who are married and aspire to be married as long as you and Barbara have? 65 years, what's your secret?
Well, the secret in love, because there are so many beautiful women out there, there's so many good-looking fellas out there, it's just something that you have to be knowledgeable about what love is. Because we have so many movies, we have so many things in the United States that sometimes that might be overdone. And if you're just going to have love, 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 and just go out and enjoy yourself and have fun, if that's what you want, that's what you're going to get. But I was raised not to fool with women. Be good to all women and men. Be kind to people and make it the best you can. And when you find somebody that loves you and you love that person, then it's up to you to be truth-wise and not be a crooked person or a person that would cheat on your wife and your wife cheat on you. So my mother used to say, if you're going to do something bad, remember your wife can do something bad too. Is that what you want? I say, no. Well, then don't do something bad. And that's what we've done, and we work very, very hard. We were never wealthy people, except that we were very wealthy in love of our children and respect for ourselves. But to me, you make money, you pay your bills, you do everything, and stay straight. And to me, that's the best way to do it. You go to sleep and never feel guilty. But if you start cheating, you're always going to remember that, oh, I should have never done that. And if you can even do that, ask for forgiveness, and you will be forgiven. And don't cheat it and do it and do it and do it like that. Make sure that you don't do something that is wrong, double, triple. Okay?
One more question for you, and feel free to add anything else, but you were a teenager in World War II. You saw guys die around you. You were almost killed yourself. You saw everything that an 18-year-old shouldn't have to see. What do you think we need to remember today about World War II, why you and so many other millions of Americans had to do what you did?
Well, you know, there's so much thinking that goes on now. I just remembered something that when I was 18 and I was pulled back, and when I got pulled back away for a couple of weeks there, our company or our platoon was attacked by the Japanese, and they had a battle there. And when I got back, they told me what happened. And it really hurt, because what happened is my captain, this guy wore a helmet, but it wasn't a steel helmet. He wore that other the plastic helmet, you know, a light one. Anyway, that he carried a pistol on his side, and they ran into a Nampu machine gun deal, and he asked for the BAR, and he took it, went up there, and shot back at the Nambu. The Nambu machine gun went bop, 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 and dot, 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 dot. It clapped. Every time it clapped, it shot about three shells, they said. And that thing was firing over, and one of the boys had a BAR and went up there and shot at him, and he came back, and the captain, he just couldn't stay back. He says, "Give me that thing," and they put the new magazine in there, and he jumped up there, and he opened up and blasted away, and he came back, and he says, "Put another magazine in there," and when he came up the second time, got a bullet right between his head. And he knocked, this guy was about 6'6", 3", wonderful guy. He'd been there something like 42 months. He was 18 years old. He was 23 years old when he was the captain. And he just plain gone. And he was one of the nicest guys. When I remember, he checked my rifle out. And he was the one that read Bohegan on it, you know. And I felt so bad. And I said to myself, you know, God has saved me, because you know, if I was there, I'd have probably done the same damn thing. But I don't think I'd be dumb enough to come up out of the same place. In other words, in all these things that you learn, you either do it or you don't. You don't come up here and shoot and then go down and come up here. You come up over here. You change your position. If you don't change your position, the guy says, that's it. I'm going to, he'll sent right on. As soon as the guy pops up, he'll get you. You just have to be lucky. You got to be lucky that you did the right thing. We had another lieutenant, got one right through his gut, right through his belly. His belly was slipped open. They put him over and they put him on the stretches and took him away. I don't know whatever happened to him, but I think he survived. But he never came back to combat, so they shipped him out. And then when I came back from Japan, we got on the ship there, and I was a sergeant, and there was another sergeant there, and we had to go down into the hold and tell your fellas, you're going to take this job. And the latrines had to be taken care of. There's two big latrines. And I'll never forget this, and I got to tell you this. The guy says, you're going to do this and that. He says, and when you get out there, he says, they're going to want to vomit. They're going to vomit as we leave. And you tell those guys, don't come into the restroom and go over the side of the ship and vomit. Well, I'm a kind of a strange sergeant. And so when we took off and I saw what was happening, I told the guys at the door, I says, you let the guy in, you put him over in that one place there, and you have him vomit there. And you clean it up just as soon as it happens. You clean it up. And so we went, and the other sergeant told him the same thing. I says, don't you let anybody, or don't turn him down. Get him over there and do it. Cleaned it up, went down there. And the funny part of it is, we got into Seattle, and when we got there, we were going to take a train and come to St. Mary, I think it was. There's a town over here where they had our place where we were going to stop at. Can't even think of the name of the place. Anyway, but when we got on the train, they put us into a special room. They got a special room, private room, shower and everything in there. And the captain of the ship came up and told us, says, this is the cleanest we've had in this ship, and I've been running this ship for 5 years. He says, this is the cleanest there was. And they said, you guys are not going to just go and sleep on the thing. We're going to give you that rest thing. And this sergeant was a Mexican fella, real nice guy, and we got to be friends after that. And he finally passed away about 10 or 15 years later. But it was just one of those things that I don't think I've been in a train since that time. Okay.
What do you think is important for us today to remember about World War II? Why does it matter? Why should it not be forgotten?
Well, first of all, you know, we've got plenty of books. We've got a lot of history. And if you think you're going to forget World War II, I don't think you ever will. The only thing is there's so many different versions of World War II, World War I, whatever it is, and a lot of stories that come out of there, and a lot of stories have been missed. There's a lot of things that people have known or didn't know and didn't talk about it. A lot of people say, well, you know, you talk about this and you talk about that, and I've had guys tell me when I get interested in something and I'm telling them, they say, every time the subject comes up, Bill, you say you know this or you know that, or well, why don't you do this or that? And a few guys have said that a few times thinking that they're really going to make me feel bad. But I tell these guys, I says, you know, you speak pretty good yourself. And they say, yeah. And I says, but you don't want to answer the questions. You don't want to talk about what you're doing. They say, no, we don't have to. I says, you know, you aren't going to talk much after we die. You know, if you got something to say, you better say it. Because after that, you ain't going to be able to be heard. So say it. And I know a fellow who was working in a bar. He did his job all the time, and I never went into bars. I don't think I've been in maybe twice in a lifetime in a bar. But this guy was a quiet guy. He looked like he could be shady, you know, in whatever he did. And he passed away, and I saw his picture, and I saw his name. He was an Armenian fellow, and he was in the Korean War. And there was the plane, the soldiers were trapped in a particular place, and they couldn't get him out. They were scared to get him. And this guy says, no. He says, you tell me where they are. I'm going in there with a helicopter and get him. He says, you know, you may not come out. He says, I don't care. He says, they're over there, and if they're there and you guys are telling me their contact, I'm going in and get them. I'll be a son of a gun. He goes up, he goes in there, lands in there, picks up the guys. They fire at him and everything else, but they don't get it down. He brings it up and brings them home. Now, this guy is working in a bar. Now, I look at him. He's a nice-looking fella. But I'm saying to myself, working in a bar every day, and this guy did this in this war and never told anybody about it. And I'm just telling you right now, if you got something to say, say it. Because this guy, I was thinking of him as a low beer way of life, you know. But the kind of guts he had to save all those guys, now that, to me, is wonderful. Just absolutely wonderful. That man should be patted on and told that he did a wonderful thing, buck himself up, and maybe he'll even get a job at a different place and work somewhere where you don't have to get drunk. I could have probably played or gotten into baseball, but I didn't want to get into professional because we'd be on a train, I'd be on an airplane or whatever it'd be, and I'd be away from my family, and I couldn't have my wife be there and for weeks on time be away from my wife. And so we played softball, we played basketball, we did all these things. And in baseball, I played in 1950, we took the open champion in softball, open league. And then the year or two after that, I got into some other teams. They folded these other guys out. And we got in there, we had three more years of championship open right down the line. And hitting the ball and all that. In high school, I played Roosevelt. And I batted a single, a double, a triple, and a homer. Had a 1,000 on that. And my batting average in 1943 was .487 for the year. And in softball, I played a few places there in tournaments and all those other things. And I've gone through some pretty tough deals, but I've had one was .400 average. I had another one that was 552. That was a Taft. We went four or five nights and played until about 11, 12 o'clock and came back. And there was a lot of these things that we've done. And in basketball, I've made it, All-City twice, once a center and once forward. And so there was a lot of things that I've done. But to me, it was just playing ball, just having fun. And the guys with me, I love them all. And a lot of them have all gone, passed on. But make the best of your life the best you can. And always admire people that even play better than you can. And encourage them not to be backward. Get in there and do the best you can. And when you lose, be a good loser, not a bad loser.